Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week we return north of the wall to revisit Jon Snow and his burgeoning love affair with free folk culture. Because I'm a glutton for punishment, I decided I would try another fan roundtable, this time with folks across the pond. My guests are mathematician Padraic McCarron and filmmaker Hazel Green. Hazel is a new guest. I call her a filmmaker. She works in all kinds of media. She's worked in animation and video game creation and documentary and theater. Of course, you can check all that out on her IMDb page. Padraic, of course, is no stranger to Electric Boogaloo. You know that he teaches at the University of Limerick. Just a quick announcement. After this chapter, I will be taking a break from A Clash of Kings, and I will be republishing the podcast Steve Osborne and I did on season one of House of the Dragon. So we published those originally over on the Double Dragon feed. So many people who listen to this book-centric program have not heard those. So if you want to do a rewatch of season one of House of the Dragon, this could serve as your companion podcast. So episode one of season one of House of the Dragon coverage begins next week. Without further ado, here is Hazel and Padraic.
I felt that, well, I don't spend any time on Reddit. I'm not kind of, deep in the lore and the mythology, and that's not to denigrate it. I just felt that I would someone who's just sort of failed to get it or something. I don't know. It's hard to imagine now. But then about 2 years ago, I just started reading and couldn't stop, and then I read all the series so far, and then last year I read them all again, so that's where I'm at.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like you can get the impression from Reddit that this story is just so dense that unless you devote your life to it, you're not going to actually understand. But I find the books, at least the first few books in the series, quite accessible. I don't know how you found them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was straight in there, really. I think it had helped me a lot, I think, listening to the podcasts. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to know because I didn't approach them without that. So, but certainly the writing and the reading of it is, it's a delight. It's not tricky at all.
Yeah, so if you're one of those very strange listeners to this podcast who do not actually read the chapters, let this be a little endorsement. Like, you might enjoy it. If you pick up the book, you might actually enjoy reading it. Okay. Last time I did a fan roundtable, it kind of turned into a mutiny. And I'm hoping it doesn't come to that this go around. My hope is that by inviting you fine folk, we'll have a more civilized conversation than my last fan roundtable.
How naive, Anthony.
All right. So why don't I go ahead and read my synopsis and then we can jump into the chapter. Corrin's band of scouts do their best to remain undetected as they draw nearer to the wildling encampment. As Jon dreams, he sees through Ghost's eyes and feels the absence of his pack. Still dreaming, he finds a thin weirwood tree and has a conversation with a voice. Somehow he recognizes his conversant as his brother. Through the tree, his brother touches him and shows him a gathering of thousands of free folk, all settled near a frozen river. Ghost is attacked by an eagle. Once awake, Jon describes the dream to Corrin, and Eben calls Jon a skin changer. The next day, they find Ghost with a wound where the eagle attacked. Seeing an eagle spying on them, Corrin decides that they ought to flee. Dalbridge, however, will stay behind to give them cover. But as they try to escape, they hear a wildling horn behind them. Hazel, let's start with you. What did you want to talk about related to this chapter?
First of all, I wanted to just sort of, from what I was just saying earlier about rereading properly this particular chapter, and Martin's description of the landscape, how richly he's able to paint that picture when really it's just, it's a lot of rock, you know.
A lot of rock and snow for sure, right?
Yeah, it's not even, it doesn't even seem like the snow is where they are particularly, the, you know, but there's nothing growing there. It's just different kinds of shapes of rock. Yeah. But of course he talks about how the shadow and the shapes and the narrowness of it and the emotion and the journey onwards and upwards. And I just wanted to say how much I appreciated that and realized, you know, how brilliant he is at describing landscapes. Well, you asked us, Anthony, for something that we may have noticed about this chapter, what stood out.
Yeah.
And I realized that there's something I hadn't noticed before, and I wonder what you think about this, is that when John is speaking with Corin, he is compared to Mans Rayder.
Yeah.
And that had not really occurred to me before, this kind of parallel between John and Mans.
Yeah, they're both bad at obeying, in John's mind.
John sort of volunteers that himself, doesn't he? And then that leads Corin to say, and you let her go, you let Ygritte go. But there seems to be, you know, more in parallel there, that they were kind of orphaned. You know, how much of his blood is wildling blood? And did Mans want to become a king? Kind of a leader, was he? And this seems to be leading us towards thoughts and questions and almost a training of John to be, what kind of leader is he going to be? Is he going to be a king? And I expect there's already a lot of discussion about that, but that was something that occurred to me, and I was quite proud of myself for seeing something, you know, bigger.
I hadn't really made the connection between Mance's kind of trajectory toward coronation and John's, but there is a question in the previous chapter about whether John might have, you know, wildling or free folk blood in him, you know, based on this little story about Bale the Bard, which he kind of refuses. But the second parallel, of course, is that, you know, in John's mind, he thought he had been commanded to kill Ygritte, and he decided not to do that. And I think he's feeling guilty about that. And so he kind of views himself as something of a disobedient ranger. And, of course, I think Corin disabuses him of that notion. But did you pick up on this at all, Podrick? And I wonder if you have any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think I picked it up more so almost from the last chapter with Ygritte's story. I kind of, that was where I started, because again, I know from later on that Mance went to Winterfell and called himself Abel as an anagram of Bale the Bard. So then when Ygritte is telling the story of Bale the Bard.
Yeah, say that again.
so in a later book, when I think it's just the next book, when John is talking to Mance, Mance tells him he's seen him twice, once when he was a boy, and once more recently when the king, when Robert went to Winterfell, because he wanted to see Robert in the flesh, and he wanted to see Benjen Stark, who was causing them a lot of grief. And when he then goes back to Winterfell in A Dance with Dragons, he calls himself Abel, A-B-E-L, which is an anagram of Bale the Bird.
Got it.
But I'm pretty sure he points out, or I think I thought at the time, maybe I've forgotten, or maybe I just thought that it was clear, but I thought he actually pointed out that it was an anagram of Bale the Bird. Or not, maybe he didn't say anagram, but like he called himself Abel because of Bale the Bird. So then when in the previous chapter, I know that from Dance with Dragons, so then when I read the previous chapter to this, when Ygritte is telling the story of Bale the Bard, I was that's when I started seeing parallels a bit more between John and Mance before this particular chapter. But also I was very surprised that John is thinking he doesn't obey, you know, he he is fairly obedient. He certainly speaks his own mind, but he generally, I would have thought he is relatively obedient compared to some other people in Night's Watch.
Yeah, I mean, I think John has kind of a scolding voice at times in his head. And I do think that he's trying to, I mean, this is kind of key to what he's going to become in short order. He kind of feels a conflict between, you know, maybe what is right in terms of following orders versus right, you know, what he feels in his heart is morally right. You know, he says, I looked in her eyes like my father taught me before I, you know, was going to take her head. And when I looked in her eyes, I saw no evil there. And I mean, I thought that that was kind of an interesting conflict between, I don't know, head and heart. I don't know. I maybe ethically speaking, you know, why would I kill someone who's not evil? I don't see the value here. And of course, it could just be very simple. It could be like, it's an attractive young lady, I'm not going to kill her. You know, maybe it's as simple as, you know, teenage boy brain logic.
We'll stay warmer if we stay close. Bet you freeze to death before I do.
Stop moving.
I'm just trying to get comfortable.
Stop it. You're still moving.
Was I? No, I didn't notice that time.
Corin follows that up with, but she was just the same as the other two, which you murdered, you know, which we did kill. There's a lot of discussion of, you know, morals and ethics in this little conversation that they have. You know, Corin's an interesting character from that point of view. I mean, none of us can imagine ourselves not pulling the sword to one side and not cutting Ygritte's head off. We can't imagine that, but that is warfare, isn't it?
I suppose a key difference here is that John isn't very seasoned. So like Corin and all the older Night's Watch, their only enemy has always been the wildling. And so they've always been a scourge to them. Whereas John's first encounter or enemy at the wall was the whites. So he knows what's truly out there. Mm. And then he's never fought the wildlings before. His first kill was in the previous chapter when he jumped down to kill, I think, Aurel is what we find out it is later. So to him, the wildlings aren't really the enemy. And that's probably part of the difference between when he's fighting Aurel, his life or death, versus when he has to actually murder someone effectively who hasn't done anything. Whereas I think if it was an older Night's Watch person, they would never have questioned killing a wildling,
right?
Because they're just used to dealing with them. And this is part very important for John's story arc, because he's so sympathetic to the wildlings compared to all the older generation.
Okay. I like this conversation, and I actually want to move to a discussion along these lines. But before we do, I thought it was interesting to note that Mance. Okay, so this is something that I fixated on, but Corin is talking about Mance, and he has affection for him.
Yeah,
and he says, you know, he was the best of us. And he actually has a fair amount of affection for the wildlings in general. But Mance in particular, he seems to have he holds in high regard. And John notes, oh, they weren't just colleagues. They were brothers. Or not, they weren't just brothers. They were friends. That's what
friends.
He says.
Yeah.
And he notes that. And of course, this serves a little bit more to blur the line between friend and enemy for John, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Corin he's training John, isn't he? He's not just a great role model. He is actually, I think, training him while he knows he can. I mean, that does make me think, I wonder why Corin asked for John to come with him on this.
It's a good question.
This scouting trip. In the show, John volunteers himself, and Mormon allows him to go. But in the book here, we see that Corin specifically kind of asks for him.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much about warging, of skin changing, he's thinking of in advance vis-a-vis the eagles.
Yeah, I asked that question too. Like, does Corin, who's sort of become an expert on Northern culture, does Corin make John for a warg immediately? Does he think, I'm going to need that guy because that guy has these set of skills that will be useful. He might be young, but he's the dude's magic. We're going to bring the magic guy with us if we can.
Yeah, I did make me wonder, you know, because otherwise he seems like an entirely practical guy, you know, who's spent his life, you know, eating roots and killing, you know.
What do you think, Padraig? Do you think that Corin knows or at least suspects that John is a skin changer?
Well, he definitely suspects. So actually, you asked us to bring an observation to question, and my question was, did Corin pick John because he knew he was a warg instantly?
Yeah.
I think the answer is he does. Mm. So he says at the time something about the wolf will come in handy. Mm. But I'm pretty sure as this conversation in this chapter in particular goes on, it's clear that Corin has already discussed with Jorah Mormont about the trees having, I think there, he says, do I have the quote here? I had it highlighted, but I can't see it. Okay, so yeah, the cold winds are rising. Mormont feared as much. Benjen Stark felt it as well. Dead men walk and the trees have eyes again. Why should we balk at wargs and giants? Mm-hmm. So it's clear that him and Mormont have discussed this, and it's even possible that Mormont is aware of John's connection to Ghost and had said this to Corin. But I think it's like, if you look at the party Corin brings, he brings one of the best archers in the Night's Watch. He brings one of the best climbers in the Night's Watch. He brings someone, if they can capture someone, can make anyone talk. Mm. He's probably one of the most seasoned rangers. And then he brings like a very fresh faced young, what's John's role? Is Mormont's not squire, but you know, he's not even a ranger.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an unusual choice without relying on some skill. So presumably, warg is the only reason I could see him bringing John. I don't think, like, he's clearly giving him a lot of lessons. He's giving him two lessons in this chapter on how to be a good leader. He says something like, to lead men, you must know them, Jon Snow. And then he also is giving him a lesson on basically how to become a spy, because he clearly knows already that John is going to have to join the wildlings, and that saving Ygritte was actually a good decision.
Yeah, so there's something about Corin that feels like, once I know something about you, I'll know how to use you. So what is
he explicitly says?
Yeah, what does he know about John? He knows that John has a bit of affection for Ygritte, and he has got compassion, and I think he recognizes a similarity with Mance. Like, I might be able to use John to ingratiate himself into the wildling culture. That might be his special skill to actually defect. And if I can get him, because he does remind me of Mance, maybe he can get close enough with Mance to kill him.
I don't think he would have sent him on an assassination mission. No, it's interesting, because even though Corin says all that about the dead men walk and the trees have eyes again, still his fear is that the wildlings will get south of the wall, and that's what they're trying to protect, which is sort of conflicting with when he explicitly says it's dead men walk, right? Because clearly he knows the dead should be the enemy more so than the wildlings, and he does have affection or understanding for wildlings.
I was gonna ask this question about Corin. I was struggling with his motivations. I want to ask you both this question. What is it that motivates Corin? Because he clearly, I mean, he says, look, they're as brave, the wildlings are as brave as us. They're as smart as us. Let me try that. Say that phrase again. They're as smart as us. And, you know, he understands that they have a whole culture. You know, he's tapped into, like, you know, songs, and, you know, that they, you know, they have this weird idea that, you know, they're all as autonomous as a king and all as wise as a maester. And he doesn't view them as evil, right?
Mm.
And, you know, one of his best friends is King of the Wildlings now. So I'm wondering what it is about Corrin Halfhand that keeps him going. Like, why he's equally appreciative of wildling culture and also determined to defeat them. So what motivates this guy?
He's pretty explicit about this when he's talking to Jorah Mormont before they leave. He said, like, you know, their lives are to be spent in service of the realm. And if they can buy extra time for the realm to get more men north to protect. So he's very much about keeping, I guess, Westeros as it is. So I think he does respect and appreciate the wildling culture. But I guess he worries if 100,000 of them go south of the wall, that they won't go peacefully and that will cause anarchy. But surely he must... it must be more than this, and he's just not vocalizing it, right? Because the fact that him and Mormont have discussed about whites and explicitly the trees having eyes again, like, how do they know that? And what do they think that means? They must be worried about this. So I would say his motivation is also fear that the dead will come south or come down. But he seems to be very much like one of the few kind of Night's Watch people we meet who's very, very sternly upholds his vows and believes them.
If we go along with this idea that he is thinking way ahead, several steps ahead, that he's thinking maybe John will need to get the wildlings on side, you know, what John ends up doing, which is bringing them into Castle Black in order to defeat the real enemy. I don't know if that,
or even stop the real enemy's numbers growing, right? Which is what John's fear is. You know, if the wildlings are killed and they come back as the dead, that's much more of a threat.
Yeah. That's interesting.
That possibly is his motivation, because he does say as well, only fools like is it Thorin Smallwood despise the wildlings. So he's not very clear. He's quite an enigma, Corrin, really, because up to now, all the Night's Watch we've met really are quite cynical, with exception of maybe Benjen Stark, who's like this, you know, the first ranger. And then we meet Corrin, and you're like, well, why is he not the replacement for Benjen? He seems perfect in every way.
Sweet Child of Time is a podcast that has recapped every episode of 1899, Dark, and The Wheel of Time. And we will be recapping Season 3 of Wheel of Time as it airs. Join me, Steve Barnes of the band Introvoid, and my roster of co-hosts, including film critic Lindsay Dunn, as we recap our favorite TV shows and movies related to time, including Time Bandits, Death Clock, and more. Sweet Child of Time on Spotify, Apple, everywhere podcasts are. Check us out, Sweet Child of Time.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre, We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
This kind of makes me wonder, does Corin have the idea of John's ultimate defection in mind from the start? Maybe if you cut off the head and kill one man, you avert a war. A war would kill thousands. And so maybe it's like, it's because of my affection for humanity that I want to avert this war. And, you know, maybe it'll take this kid getting close enough to kill the king.
He does seem very interested in, like, training John, doesn't he? So, like, not just to become a leader. But I wonder, does he suspect, because John is a warg, that the Night's Watch can't really do much for him in that training? Mm. So if he can join the wildlings for a while and learn how to control that and hone that, maybe he will be more useful to the Watch and more useful to the realm, especially now that, you know, the dead are up again.
But is there any evidence that he gets them deliberately caught by the wildlings, which leads to his own death?
He definitely doesn't deliberately, no. But he suspects it will happen, and I do think he is trying to get John to appreciate the wildling. So even if he, like, it does seem like it's a last resort getting John to go to the wildlings, but in this particular case, but you don't know, or it's not clear if he always has this in mind for John, you know, to become some kind of mm-hmm. spy, and this is his first, like, he definitely doesn't intend for them all to die in this expedition, that's for sure.
Okay, so we got your question, Padraig. What about your observation?
Yeah, my observation, this is something I never noticed before. And it was when John is warged into Ghost and he sees the weirwood and he says, it's no more than a sapling, yet it was growing as he watched. So I always had it in my head that weirwoods were ancient and there since the time of the old gods. But this is clearly a new one. And it was just growing out of, like, this little crack in the rock. I didn't actually highlight that part. So it seems like new weirwoods are growing and being added to this network of weirwoods that future Bran can see through. So that observation that weirwoods are actually growing again was what I brought.
How much of that... All right, I have questions too, because it has a face on it, right?
Mm.
So because it has a face, and initially it's just like a carved face. Eventually it's kind of... I mean, I'm imagining it kind of morphs into a more human face. But I'm wondering, because of all of that and because of what you just said, how much of this dream is visionary and how much of this is really happening?
Hazel, do you want to go first there?
Well, it's that sort of hinterland, isn't it? A liminal space between the two. But
yeah.
Bran, as the three-eyed, because he talks about having opening your third eye. He's instructing John that he's needed now to tap into his abilities. But Bran reaches out and touches Ghost.
This is what I was wondering about. Yeah.
He touches Ghost and kind of sort of passes on the, you know, it's like he's passing on the kind of power. As he's saying, you must use your power now.
The tree touches the wolf. Like, if we are imagining that this is what actually happened, like that, you know, John is asleep and his consciousness is seeing through Ghost's eyes what is actually occurring in the real world. We have to imagine that a tree branch reaches down and touches a wolf somehow, which that to me is kind of like, how much of this is just part of the visionary experience?
Yeah.
I would have thought this is one of the few dreams that is almost entirely literal and happens. With that exception of the tree branch touching, everything else seems to happen and be real. So it begins with him as Ghost, and Ghost is lamenting that he can't hear his brothers and sister. So Ghost is aware this lady is dead. And then he hears someone calling John, looks around, sees the weirwood. And in the weirwood, he sees Bran, basically, a boy with, did my brother always have a third eye? So it's a little bit confusing because initially he's talking about his brothers and one sister. So the brothers clearly are the wolves here. But then in the next paragraph, he sees the tree and he says, does my brother always have a third eye? So initially when I read that, I was thinking, that sounds like, is his brother here? Is this John's brother or is this Ghost's brother?
Interesting.
So that was a little bit of a confusing one. But anyway, he smells the tree and smells like wolf, tree, and boy, and there are other scents. And then, this tree reaches and touches Ghost, and then it's very confusing what actually happens because suddenly he's back up in the mountain. So it's like Ghost has his memory lost, right? And this is quite vivid, like his paws sink in the deep snow. And then he goes up and he looks down and he sees the eagle. And we know everything after this does happen. And we know the beginning does happen.
Okay, there's a few things here that I want to call out. So as is Martin's way, he'll introduce kind of a wind experience when he's about to go to Northern Magic. So in this, it says, but only the sound of the sigh of the blowing snow. So so it's windy, right? And then he hears the voice, John. And it's a question mark, John. And then he turns around and he sees a weirwood. And so because it's the wind's blowing, which of course is a literary clue to us, but because it's a little sapling and the wind's blowing, you could imagine the branches kind of moving in the wind. So maybe that kind of solves the issue. Otherwise, we have to imagine that some three-eyed crow has the ability to move the branches of this tree. Maybe I'm focusing too much on this, but then it's interesting. After that, it says, "Wary, he circled the smooth white trunk until he came to the face. Red eyes looked at him, fierce eyes as they were, yet glad to see him. The weirwood had his brother's face, had his brother always had three eyes." So somehow, through the wolf's eyes, he's not just looking at the carved tree face. He actually can see more, and he can see into the tree to what he recognizes as his brother's face. So can a direwolf see more of the spirit world than a human can? That's the first question. And then secondly, is it better just to think of this as, well, this is a dream. You see weird stuff, even if it's sort of conveying the reality through the wolf's eyes, part of the dream is going to be a little bit abstract.
Because he initially starts the dream as a wolf, though, it would be a bit weird to like be dreaming about being a wolf and then actually warg into the wolf, right? Normally, if he's dreaming being wolf, he actually has warged. And can I also just say, you attribute the wind way too much to Bran. Every time the wind blows, this is not we're in the frozen north.
But it's pretty common that when something magic like this is going to happen, the first clue that it's about to happen is that Martin will give us some kind of wind indication. And it's not necessarily just Bran, it's Arya. You know, there are a lot of characters in this story who are in proximity to Weirwood. Something, there's some kind of divine potency to the wind.
Yeah, I guess the sort of wind rustling the trees is a common theme.
Maybe you're right. Maybe I am reading too much into it. It just happens to be a pattern I've noticed.
Okay, so I can see the blowing wind being related to the Weirwood, but my interpretation of this was that everything was quite literal. It is confusing about how the Weirwood, he sees it growing as he's watching it. So that is the first part that indicates maybe it is a vision, and then the tree reaches down and touches him. I did highlight or question why, when he sees the young tree, that it was growing as he watched. I still didn't take it as a dream, but that confused me.
Okay. The next question I was going to ask, and I'll ask both of you, this is sort of Hazel's question. Are we sure this is Bran? In order for this to be Bran, I think we have to incorporate a bit of time travel, right?
Yeah.
And well, I don't know if the story has properly introduced the concept yet.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that I knew what I was reading. You know, I just kind of go along with it like it's a dream. But Bran's name is never mentioned. He just says, my brother. Because Bran currently is on route away from Winterfell, isn't he, with Hodor.
Winterfell has just been sacked or just been taken by Theon at this point.
Oh, no, well, they're hiding. Actually, they're hiding.
Yeah, they're probably in the crypts, right?
They're
yeah.
still hiding in the crypts, are they?
Yeah.
Actually, we don't know. I don't know for sure if the time is the same place, right? Because Martin doesn't order the books, the story chronologically. So this could be a few months before or after. That's not actually clear to us. But if we're just going by this kind of discourse time, the last Bran chapter was just after Theon takes Winterfell.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, Bran isn't aware of, or, you know, he's not a practiced.
Yes, exactly. In fact, he says, have you always had three eyes? And he says, not before the crow. And that to me suggests that on the Green Seer side of this conversation, if it is Bran, he's speaking from the future. He's speaking post Dance of Dragons. And so, okay, here's the alternative. If we don't want to say that this is Bran, earlier in the chapter, we get a little reminder that the Night's Watch refer to each other as brothers, right? He says, oh, Corn and Mance, they weren't just brothers, they were friends. Reminding us that the Night's Watch call themselves brothers. He never says the name Bran, he just says, I see the face of my brother. And we know that the Three-Eyed Crow was once a member of the Night's Watch. So I don't know if this, I mean, this, Bloodraven was at least at one point a member of the Night's Watch. So that would be an alternative here, but I think the best explanation is Bran. That's my feeling.
There's also, he sniffed at the bark, smelled of wolf and tree and boy. So like that, it has to be Bran given the, so it's like someone we know with three eyes, someone who's got a boy and has a wolf, and calls out John's name so that they know John. And it's if it's his brother. Like, I mean, it has to be Bran. It has to be Bran from the future. And I think if you just read this in isolation, that might be a bit surprising, that because this is effectively time travel. But now that we know the story with Hodor and how he lost his mind, there's actually the idea of Bran being able to see back in time, affect the past, has been established previously. So this isn't the first instance of this. Hodor's existence is probably the first instance of this.
Yeah, but we wouldn't know. Like, at this point, if you're just reading the books for the first time, you wouldn't know this. So I think...
No.
I think that we should be confident that this is Bran, although there are alternative readings. I think that the best reading This is Brandon. If that's the case, this is kind of our first confirmation of warging backwards into time. Something like green scene backwards into time.
Well, none. I mean, we can't say that. For all we know, it could just be Bran asleep, right? Because the Three-Eyed Crow came to Bran first after he had his fall and his dreams then. So we could just assume at this point it's Bran dreaming or maybe doing some kind of
green scene. Okay.
That we don't know
I'm
about.
So glad you mentioned that. Let me read this little section. I think I might have a different view of it now. He sniffed at the bark, smelled wolf and tree and boy.
Yeah.
But behind that, there were other scents. A rich brown smell of the warm earth and hard gray smell of stone and something else, something terrible. Death, he knew. He was smelling death. He cringed back. His hair bristled. And bared his fangs. Don't be afraid. This is the voice from the tree. Don't be afraid. I like it in the dark. No one can see you, but you can see them. But first you have to open your eyes. See like this. And he reached down and touched him. So is the death part of it, that the fact that maybe he's in the crypts?
Crypts at Winterfell. Yeah.
It could be, yeah. I actually did not cop that. I had another question about what that death could mean.
Because I was going to ask, what is the stuff? Like, I understand what the boy and the wolf is and the rich brown smell of earth. I was thinking probably, you know, Blood Raven, he's kind of merged with the tree or whatever. Now Bran's going to do that. But the hard gray smell of stone, what is that?
Yeah, and don't be afraid. I like it. I like it in the dark.
I mean, the stone could be the stone engravings of the kings of Winterfell, right?
Yeah.
And just the fact that they're in crypts, which are stone, right?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, that could make sense. I thought he just meant because he was sort of under the tree roots or something, but I didn't understand specifically what the death was, but that would make sense of them sort of connecting together while they're asleep.
Interesting.
Yeah, and we also know that the direwolves fear the crypts, so Bran couldn't get Summer to go into the crypts in at the end of Game of Thrones. And now Shaggy Dog was in there actually at the time, but Bran couldn't convince Summer to go down.
Interesting.
And in general, they seem to fear death. Like, Ghost wouldn't go to the Fist of First Men either because there was so much association with death.
All right. I'm glad we had this conversation. I think I don't have a solution at this point. I'm pretty sure this is Bran, but I'm happy that to be corrected on the time travel stuff. I don't know that we've solved it, but I think I'm reading this more carefully.
So is this the first time that John has experienced this? I can't remember. Is this his first time being inside Ghost's body, seeing through his eyes?
I just looked through the chapters because I asked this question as well, and I think it's the first time it's very explicit, but I don't think it's the first time because I think there's comments of him having wolf dreams frequently, but this is the first time. Maybe it's not the first time. Maybe there's a time around Craster's.
Yeah, we have indications that these two are connected for sure. This is the first time I think it's explicit to the reader. It's the first time the word skin changer is used specifically of John. John wonders, like, is he talking about the eagle or is he talking about me? And in that moment, it kind of feels like that seems like out of a story, but it kind of fits. And I think the confirmation is that we know that Corn is open to the idea, right? Maybe he even suspects it. But what ends up happening is that he hears the dream. He hears about the eagle attacking Ghost. But Corn does not turn back until they find Ghost and see that Ghost is actually wounded in real life. So I almost feel like Corn gets confirmation that this was not a dream. The suspicions have been confirmed. He was actually seen through the eyes of the wolf, and I've got all of the information that I need to have about the wildling host.
Yeah, I think Corrin already did believe it. It does seem like they are just going on to rescue Ghost.
But it wasn't until they found Ghost that he actually turned back. We're going back up the mountain.
Yeah.
And all of the other Rangers are like, what? Why are we turning back now? Yeah. And my feeling is that it's because Corrin needed that extra little bit of confirmation that the eagle attack really happened in real life.
Well, it means they've been seen. He knows they've been seen. That's the way I interpreted that. He knows the eagle is their eyes. If Ghost's been seen, then they've been seen. And
I'm glad that we're talking about the eagle. Like every chapter Podrick and I cover together, there's some magic bird.
Right? Yes. Oh, right. Yeah.
There's some magic bird.
Yeah, I was going to point that out.
In this case, maybe the most magic bird of all. So we find out later that the man that John kills, it's his first kill as a soldier, is a man named Orel, or Orel. I don't know how to say the name, but and Orel was himself a skin changer. And the reason why we know this is because he was connected to this eagle, and seemingly when Orel was murdered, a part of him is now sort of living in the eagle, and the eagle now has hatred for Jon Snow, according to Ygritte. So I just thought that was, to me, it was fascinating that the very first person Jon kills is a skin changer.
It's kind of unfortunate that him and Stone Snake didn't swap around, isn't it? 50-50 there.
Also interesting that he's more, in the next chapter, he's much more concerned that he didn't kill Ygritte. He doesn't seem concerned at all that he just killed a guy.
Doesn't he justify that here, though, with when he's talking to Corrin, and he's just like, you know, it was us or them. Like, they would have killed us if we hadn't killed them. It sort of had to be done. That was how I read it. I didn't think... And I do think he has a bit of a thing for Ygritte, like, immediately. He doesn't... It's not said in his thoughts. But I do think that is... Mm-hmm. It's no surprise that later on that they do kind of... get together, right?
I think so. There's a couple indications that he's interested in Ygritte from the start.
Well, can I just ask a basic question? Mm-hmm. Is skin changing and warging the same, or is there a difference?
My understanding from reading is that warging is specifically into wolves and dogs, whereas skin changing is into anything.
Yeah, that's been my impression.
Is warg means wolf or dog? Dog? Warg? Is a warg?
Aren't wargs the name of the wolves in Lord of the Rings?
Yeah, right. So I always right. imagine this as kind of a an homage to Tolkien, but sort of a emerging that mythology with kind of a werewolf mythology. I mean, that's just been my impression. Hi, folks. Just green scene into this podcast from the future. Something that is relevant to this conversation that I forgot that might be interesting is that in Old Norse, vargr, V-A-R-G-R, simply means wolf, which I knew and forgot. What I did not know was that it can also mean outlaw, which I find interesting. Also, I did not know that the word werg, W-E-A-R-G, in Old English means wolf. But I would imagine that he's taking this from the Old Norse. All right, back to the conversation. You know, in this world, later on we meet this character, Varamyr Sixskins.
Yeah.
And we learned a lot more about sort of the mechanics behind skin changing. In this world, it's like projecting your psyche into an animal, and if you do it near the end of your life, you can have a second life. And anyway, so.
We also get Varamyr does warg or skin change into that eagle. And or it's confirmed then that Orel is in the eagle. And then Melisandre kills the eagle.
Yeah.
And they're, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Or burns That's the right. eagle.
Man. This stuff's complicated.
So, notable introductions. I thought that this is sort of our first introduction to time travel. And after this conversation, I'm a little bit more dubious about that. I don't. Here's the argument against. Bran is not very talented as a green seer yet, or at least his talent hasn't been sort of honed and trained. So is he the kind of guy that can would be able to talk through the tree yet?
Yeah, it is confusing because there is no tree where Bran is. So how is he getting to that? But also, maybe as Hazel mentioned earlier, maybe that tree isn't actually really there, because it is a bit weird. There's like this barren area, and this tree is growing out of some fissures, and it's growing as they speak. So maybe it is more dreamlike than I initially interpreted it. I think
They're just connecting through their dream states or something.
Potentially, yeah, connecting through the wolves are connected, and these are probably the closest wolves in proximity to each other, and you know, maybe John's powers are enhancing as well, so they can become more connected.
So introduction to the eagle, introduction to a few folks by name that we hadn't met before. I guess Squire Dalbridge. They call him Squire because he was once a squire to a king. So he just kind of kept the nickname.
Did you try and figure out who that was? Because I did take a quick look, but it wasn't very clear.
I mean, it's got to be some Targaryen king, right?
Yeah, that was what I assumed as well. And then he was just something bad happened, so he ended up going to the wall. Presumably, this was pre-Robert Rebellion.
Right. I mean, I don't know if we have much more than that, but unless you've got more evidence.
No, I didn't. I did quickly try and look it up, but I didn't find anything about it. But it did pique my interest. All right, this idea that he was squire to a king. It was like, I thought that was possibly significant, but it doesn't seem to be.
Well, R.I.P.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, yeah, notable departure, Dalbridge.
Indeed.
So, interesting to me that, all right, I listened to this chapter on audio last night, and then I reread it this morning. In the audio, the voice actor... Who's the voice actor? He was also in the show. What's his, I forget his name now.
Roy Dotrice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So Dotrice says this line as if it is the voice from the tree. This is no army, no more than it is a town. This is a whole people come together. So those words are in italics. They're not in quotations. So it's sort of a thought rather than a something that's spoken out loud. Dotrice interprets this as the green seeing voice out of the tree. But if I was going to, when I read this the second time, I thought, oh no, this is just John thinking to himself. He's sort of interpreting what he's seen. To me, this changes the motivation, assuming that this is Bran. This changes the motivation of Bran. Is Bran trying to tell John, you should have sympathy for these people? This is not an army. This is a people. Or is this John listening to his own conscience? Like, oh, this is not an army. This is a whole culture. He's starting to be attracted to it in the same way Mance was. What do you guys think about this?
I would say that it's just simply the whoever was directing Roy Dotrice just, you know, they just made a slight mistake. Because these things happen. Sounds to me that, as you say, if it's in italics, then it's John's dream voice, his conscience talking to himself.
What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I took it fully to be John. I think my interpretation, and maybe this has changed over the course of the conversation, is that with the tree reaching out and touching Ghost, this has made John more... like a better warg. It's enhanced his powers somehow. And now instead of just being in Ghost and kind of doing what Ghost wants to do, he's in Ghost, but he's having his own subconscious, his own thoughts as well.
So that's you're taking this anyway. As this is sort of John's inner monologue.
This is John's inner monologue. This is John seeing. No, I didn't even consider anything after that. After that, suddenly, I think Bran is gone from the picture. That was how I read it anyway.
So notable differences. This whole thing is not in the show, this entire chapter. But I think that we have a notable difference between the audiobook and the printed page. And this is one of the few times where I actually would like to ask Martin, like, what did you intend here? I think we're right. I think that this is John's conscience. I don't think that this is Bran's commentary.
No.
I'd be very surprised if it was Bran's commentary, yeah.
All right, okay.
Also, Bran wouldn't have, again, why, I know Bran has got OSHA, but why would he have sympathy or interest in the Wellings, especially at this point, because is this future Bran you're thinking it is?
If it's future Bran, maybe he does have, he is a wider and more wise perspective on wildling culture.
I would assume that Bran's time in the Weirwood is very short, so I would say he will see things and learn things, but he won't be like Bloodraven, who we meet as an old man who's grown into a tree. I think Bran will leave, and I think the idea of Hodor will help him escape. So I don't think he will be in the Weirwood net for very long to be maybe that active or have that much future information.
I think I'm coming around to the opinion that this is, well, number one, I do think that this is not Bran's voice here. It's confusing because the voice from the tree is only set in italics earlier in the chapter. It's not in quotations. So it is ambiguous. But I think in this case, this is not Bran's voice, and no confirmation of time travel yet. I think I'm coming around to that view.
Can I ask Anthony, just on that scene, when he's looking at this, so many men, thousands, a huge host, some were tearing great holes in the half-frozen ground. What did you interpret that to mean?
Tearing holes into the half-frozen ground.
So my instinct is that, and why I'm asking, is because I assume it's them digging, looking for this horn of Jormund.
You know what? That's what it's named. You're probably right. I missed that. I was just thinking, like, well, that's how you put up a pavilion, you got to dig a hole in the ground. But clearly if you can see it from far away, these are pretty big holes, right?
Exactly, yeah.
No, that's a good catch. I missed that for sure. Any final thoughts, Hazel?
When John speaks to Corin about what happened with Ygritte, that he let her go, John approaches Corin. So I had a question about, why does he go over to Corin and then kind of try and admit that he let her go? And then it sort of comes out. Corin says, well, you let her go. You know, obviously you let her go, you know. And he says, how did you know I let her go? You know.
Yeah, he goes up to him and he says, you didn't ask me about how it went with the girl. He's almost begging for Corin. He's like, please, I need to confess this. It's like eating at me. I need to tell you that I let this wildling girl go. And I don't know. I mean, I kind of feel like maybe he has an overactive conscience, or he thinks this is valuable information. They might know of our whereabouts because I didn't do what needed to be done. And so maybe it's like, I have to tell my superior commander that we might be in trouble.
He might have compromised it. Yeah, I think that's better than my interpretation, which was that John is very like Ned. And Ned, as I've said before, is not only a terrible liar, he's not a terrible liar. Whenever Ned lies, something terrible happens, right? So, and I think John possibly is quite like this and is worried that he feels a lot of guilt about this. So he wants to admit it. And similar to Ned, I think, I haven't actually analyzed this at all, but I presume if John lies, maybe bad things also do happen. So that was So I feel like he's just scared of lying, can't lie. But no, you're right. It's definitely guilt. That's why he talks to them. I think, Anthony, your point is almost surely we actually, I possibly compromised all of us by letting this one go. So you probably should.
It might be both. Like when I'm old enough that I was spanked with a wooden spoon when I was a young boy. And so like every now and then, it would just be my mom. She would, if I really deserve something, you know, a lesson, I would get swatted with a wooden spoon. And so one day I decided I'm going to get every wooden spoon in the house. I'm going to bury them in the backyard. And I thought, this is gonna solve all the problems, because if there's no wooden spoon, I will not be spanked. And then I went and buried them, and maybe 5 minutes went by before I went and told my mom what I had done, because I felt so guilty about burying the spoons.
Please tell us the aftermath of this story.
You spanked yourself.
It was sort of like
with all the spoons.
It was sort of like, well, go dig them up and bring them back. And I did. And I was not spanked.
And then she spanked you.
She didn't spank me often. This is not a common occurrence, but that's all it took. All it took was like, well, go get them. And I did.
See, that's how it works. It's like the Panopticon, isn't it? You don't even need the spoon.
Right, exactly.
Just the idea of the spoon.
Well, that was it. In our house, we had the threat of the wooden spoon, but it was never actually used. But the threat, like, if it was even picked up, the fear and guilt I would have felt about, oh, my God, not the wooden spoon. I must have done something awful.
The spoon.
But it was never, ever used, right? And surely a wooden spoon's a terrible influence. way worse things in that kitchen.
So I think that John feels guilty about this. I do think it was the right thing to do. Like, Corin needs to know that there might be someone out there who, you know, Ygritte could easily crush their skulls in their sleep with a rock. But the greater danger is that she gets back to the army and tells Mance. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose for me it was it's a more fun way of pushing things along, you know, to have John go over and speak to Corin.
Well, and it also brings up an interesting little line. It's he says, why did you order me?
Yeah.
To execute her. And he says, oh, I didn't order you. I said, do what needs to be done. And then I thought you would figure out what that meant. And so it was almost like he gave him enough room to interpret so that he could learn something about John. What does John think needs to be done at this moment?
It's a brilliant moment of learning. What a brilliant leader Corin is.
It's too bad we don't have him much longer.
He didn't. I said, get the spoon. That's all I said was get the spoon.
Yeah, that's right.
And you just spanked yourself with it.
I like it a lot.
Corin's only in 4 chapters, isn't he? And he makes a massive impression.
I know. I was thinking I really miss this guy. And I went back and watched his scenes in the show as well. And the actor who plays him in the show, I can't remember his name, Simon Smith, but I mean, he's kind of familiar to British audiences. I like this. It's kind of almost like Wild West, isn't it? You know, it's kind of a Western scenario.
Oh, say more about that.
You know, you've got this sort of knowledgeable ranger, the kid. Who's asking all the questions or whatever, you know, and then they're each got their own skills, but it's just their own horseback.
Right. And there's almost a cowboys and Indians thing happening as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're on horseback and they're, you know, like going through the canyons and up across the Rocky Mountains or whatever, you know, and it's, they stop and they can't have a campfire.
That's really great. I never thought of it in that way before. I always thought of it in terms of like a crime drama, like he's going to end up going undercover and like, you know, because, you know, sometimes undercover cops infiltrating the mafia or something. But you're totally right. This does have something of an old Western feel to it, too.
I think so. You know, and that sense of, you know, we're all humans, you know, and there's a lot of wilding in every one of us. There's a lot to be learned about imperialism. And
I love this chapter. I'm kind of like amazed that I ever was bored with John. There's so much to talk about in terms of just the wolf's encounter with the weirwood tree. It's so sort of generative of the larger story of magic that really even if you fast forward all the way to the end of Dance, we know a lot more about the magic. There's still a lot of mystery.
Definitely. We still we still have so much to learn about, especially about really Bran and what his abilities will be. We're speculating a lot, and we speculate a lot on from the show as well, which we don't even
that's
know
right.
for
yeah.
how accurate
right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Bran's just a little mop top boy, isn't he? A little tot, isn't he? You know, he's got a little Beatles haircut, and he's underground. You know.
Hisley mentioned the actor playing Corrin being familiar to British audiences, and that just reminded me, do you associate the eagle with a Gareth in The Office, which if
oh,
you're
yes,
with
do.
The US Office, which is the Dwight character.
I do.
I do as well.
I do, yeah. Absolutely.
So Anthony, just if you're not, I don't know if you're familiar with their office, but so in the US Office, the Dwight character, he's Gareth
yeah.
in the
yeah.
UK Office. And the actor who plays Gareth is the actor who plays Arya.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
In Game of Thrones. So it's very hard for me not to see the eagle and not think of...
Mm. That's funny. I've seen a few episodes of the original Office, and I never made that connection before, but now I can see the face.
All right, mate. Probably wondering who they're going to offer David's job to. Me?
Is it? You got it?
Yes.
Oh, brilliant. Congratulations, mate.
Thank you. Right. Things are going to start changing around here, so you can start bucking your ideas up. Your appearance is going to be a well-oiled, tight ship around these here parts.
So he's just an assistant to the wildlings.